When the great bald mountain rose abruptly out of the plain, Lothar believed at first that it must be some trick of the desert light. He knew of no description in the folklore or verbal history of the desert tribes to warn that the existence of such a place was possible. The only white men who had travelled this country, Livingston and Oswell on their route to the discovery of Lake Ngami, and Anderson and Galton on their hunting forays, had made no mention of such a mountain in their writing. Thus Lothar doubted what he was seeing in the uncertain evening light, and the sunset was so laden with dust, so garish and theatrical as to heighten the effect of a stage illusion. However, in the first light of the next day, when he looked for it eagerly, the silhouette was still there, dark and clearly incised against a sky that was turned to mother-of-pearl by the coming of the dawn. As he rode towards it, so it rose higher and still higher from the plain, and finally detached itself from the earth and floated in the sky on its own shimmering mirage. When, at last, Lothar stood beneath the tall cliffs, he did not doubt that this was the sacred place of which the San had spoken as he died, and his conviction was made complete when he scrambled up the scree slopes and discovered the wondrous paintings upon the sheltered cliff face. "This is the place, but it's so extensive," Lothar realized. "If the girl is here, we might never find her. So many caves and valleys and hidden places. We could search forever." He divided his men again and sent them on foot to explore and search the nearest slopes of the mountain. Then he left the wagons in a shaded grove in the charge of Swart Hendrik, whom he mistrusted least, and taking only a spare horse set out to circumnavigate the mountain's bulk. After 2 days of travel, during which he kept notes and sketched a rough map with the aid of his pocket compass, he could estimate with some certainty that the mountain was probably about 30 miles long and 4 or 5 miles wide, a long extended ridge of gneiss and intruding sandstone strata. He rounded the eastern extremity of the mountain and deduced from his compass headings that he was heading back along the opposite side from where he had left the wagons. Whenever some feature of the cliffs caught his attention, a fissure or a complex of caves, for instance, he hobbled the horses and climbed up to explore. Once he discovered a small spring of clear, sweet water welling up from the base of the cliff and trickling into a natural rock basin. He filled his water canteens, then he stripped and washed his clothes. At last he bathed, gasping with delight at the cold, and went on refreshed. At other places he found more of the sand paintings covering the rock face, and he marvelled at the accuracy of the artist's eye and hand that depicted the shape of eland and buffalo, so that even his hunter's eye could find no fault. However, these were all ancient signs, and he found nothing of recent human presence. The forest and plain below the cliffs teemed with game, and he had no difficulty in shooting a plump young gazelle or antelope each day and keeping himself in fresh meat. On the third evening he killed an impala ewe and made a kebab of the tripes and kidneys and liver, impaling them on a green twig and grilling them over the coals. However, the scent of fresh meat attracted unwelcome attention to his camp, and he had to spend the rest of the night standing by the horses with his rifle in his hand, while a hungry lion grunted and moaned in the darkness just outside the circle of firelight. He examined the beast's tracks in the morning and found that it was an adult male, past its prime, and with a damaged limb that forced it to limp heavily. "Dangerous brute," he muttered, and hoped that it had moved away. But this was a vain hope. He discovered that evening, when the horses began to fidget and whicker at the sunset, The lion must have followed him at a distance during the day, and emboldened by the gathering dark, it again closed in and began to prowl around his campfire. Another sleepless night. He resigned himself and heaped wood on the fire. Preparing to stand guard, he pulled on his overcoat and suffered another minor irritation. One of the brass buttons was missing, which would let in the cold of the desert night. It was a long, unpleasant night. But a little after midnight, the lion seemed at last to tire of its fruitless vigil, and it moved away. He heard it utter one last string of moaning grunts at the head of the grassy flay half a mile away. Then there was silence. Wearily, Lothar checked the head halters on the horses, and then went to the fire and rolled himself in his blankets, still fully dressed, and keeping his boots on. Within minutes he had fallen into a deep, dreamless sleep. He came awake with bewildering suddenness and found himself sitting up with the rifle in his hands and the din of an angry lion's thunderous roars echoing in his ears.